It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrara.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out how the Wampanoag tribe taught the Pilgrims to farm and made the first Thanksgiving possible.
First, a federal court ruled yesterday that the legislative district maps Wisconsin Republicans redrew in 2011 violate the U.S. Constitution. This is the first ruling of its particular kind in a gerrymandering case. It could set a national precedent if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Sean Johnson joins us in studio now to talk about this federal ruling and what happens next. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for WPR News. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with yesterday's 2-1 decision from a panel of federal judges about Wisconsin's redistricting. What happened?
So what they said is that the map that was drawn by Wisconsin Republicans in 2011 is unconstitutional. And what that means next, we're going to find out over the course of the next few months. But immediately what it means is that this map that was drawn 5 years ago, if this panel of federal judges has its way, that map won't be in effect for the 2018 elections.
Now, in the past, this kind of thing has been difficult to prove for the plaintiffs who say there has been gerrymandering involved. What makes this case different, at least as the judges see it so far?
So what this case is and what differentiates it from other redistricting lawsuits out there is that this is a partisan redistricting challenge. So it's not challenging the map based on other more traditional redistricting standards, like whether it's compact or whether it preserves communities of similar interest, whether it violates the Voting Rights Act for the way it treats African-American or Latino voters. What this challenge said was that Republicans drew this map to give them a partisan advantage over Democrats for the next 10 years, and that essentially they had overwhelmingly succeeded.
And on what grounds did the Democrats bring this suit? How did they prove that this was something that you could look at, quantify, and point to gerrymandering?
They did a couple things. One, part of their case is proving a partisan intent. And at least with the two judges who wrote the majority opinion, they were convinced that that Wisconsin's case, where you had Republican aides drawing these maps across the street from the Capitol in a private law firm without any input from Democrats, where even rank-and-file Republican legislators had to sign secrecy agreements to get a look at the maps, they were convinced that the partisan intent was there for these maps. So then they set about the task of trying to come up with a way to measure that partisanship. And so that's the thing that all other redistricting challenges before this one have failed at in the eyes of the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that, you know, we all generally acknowledge that partisanship plays a role in redrawing political lines, but how do you measure that? And so they measured it with something called the efficiency gap.
And what is the efficiency gap, if you can explain it?
Yeah, so the efficiency gap basically measures wasted votes, in the words of this lawsuit. So just to give you a couple examples, so if there were a strongly Democratic legislative district where there were 10 voters, let's say, and the Democratic candidate wins 9 votes. They wasted a lot of votes because they got more votes than they needed. They got 3 votes more than they needed to win that district. So those are wasted votes in this formula. Another example would be in a district that's narrowly won by a Republican candidate. Every vote that a Democratic candidate gets that doesn't translate into a win is, under this formula, a wasted vote. So you take those wasted votes, you compare them to the statewide total of votes, and that gives you the efficiency gap. And basically what they're looking at when they calculate that efficiency gap is they're looking at to what degree does Wisconsin, which is roughly a 50-50 state, turn those votes into seats. And Republicans, even though this is roughly a 50-50 state, have been able to use their map to get nearly 2/3 of the seats in the legislature.
Now, I want to hit pause, Sean, before we keep going. And the word gerrymandering is something that, you know, you may not remember except for political science in college or high school. So give us a quick crash course in gerrymandering 101. What is the word? What does it mean? And how has it played out so far?
So traditionally, gerrymandering has meant drawing kind of funny-shaped districts in order to accomplish partisan goals. I mean, a gerrymandered map looks like a very odd jigsaw puzzle. And so what this case is doing is it's not looking at the shape of the districts to prove that it's gerrymandering. It's looking essentially at math and partisan intent by Republican legislators in this case and saying that is the gerrymandering, that you don't need to look at the shape of the districts anymore, that redistricting has become so sophisticated and the mathematical models used to draw these districts are so good that the shape's almost irrelevant, that that's where the gerrymandering comes into play in this case, although that is not the way it's traditionally been used.
Sean Johnson is with us right now. He's WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, and he's with us to talk about federal ruling from yesterday, ruling against Wisconsin's 2011 redistricting maps by a panel of federal judges. And Sean, can you tell us a little bit more about what the judges had to say in their decision?
Well, the majority opinion by Judges Kenneth Ripple and Judge Barbara Crabb. Ripple was appointed to the bench by President Reagan, Crabb by President Carter, wrote that they wrote that Act 43, which is the name of the map and statutes, quote, was intended to burden the representational rights of Democratic voters. And the judges went on to write that it had its intended effect. They said that one of the purposes of the map was to secure Republican control of the assembly under any likely future electoral scenario for the remainder of the decade. In other words, to entrench the Republican Party in power. And to come to that conclusion, they looked at the results of the 2012 and the 2014 elections and saw that, for example, in 2012, even though a majority of voters in the state had cast their ballots for Democratic candidates for the legislature, for the assembly, Republicans had come away with a very strong majority in that year. And that only has continued in 2014 and 2016.
And Judge Griesbach was the dissenting voice on this. What did he say?
He said that he wasn't going to sign on to this because this map did not violate principles that have traditionally governed the redistricting process, such as contiguity, compactness, and respect for political subdivisions like counties and cities. And he also said that, just saying that there's a political purpose or political motivation behind the map and that somehow makes it unconstitutional, he was uneasy with measuring that because essentially he's saying, how are you not going to find that with a redistricting plan? So he did not sign under that. He was appointed to the bench by President George W. Bush. So you did have a judge who was appointed by a Republican and a judge who was appointed by a Democrat. And the majority opinion and one judge appointed by a Republican dissent.
Sean, how significant is this decision so far, both for Wisconsin, but also for redistricting cases nationwide?
Until it clears that final hurdle of the U.S. Supreme Court, we don't know. But this is a pretty big deal if it survives. I mean, this would basically turn redistricting on its head and say that when you draw legislative districts, they have to have an element of competitiveness to them, that there's a new principle you have to look at when you draw these lines, and that that when one party controls everything, it can't just redistrict the other party out of political existence.
So you said this will be a big deal if it survives. So what are the next steps? What can we expect to happen?
The next step, because this is a redistricting case, the appeals go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. So that will absolutely happen. Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel said yesterday he was going to appeal this case. Republican legislators like Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who were instrumental in drawing the map, said they want that to happen, that this isn't over, basically. So you're going to see this appeal take place. And what happens from there, we don't know. We know that the plaintiffs in this case are really trying to they really drew up the case for Justice Anthony Kennedy, who back in 2004 had kind of hinted in another redistricting decision at an openness or a willingness to accept a partisan redistricting challenge if somebody could come up with some kind of metric. So that's really what this case is about, is people who wanted to make change to the redistricting process, kind of seizing on Wisconsin as an example, and they're basically putting it out there for Judge Anthony Kennedy. If he were to say and join the court's liberal members and say, we agree this map is unconstitutional. The efficiency gap is a good way to measure whether that's the case. It would change redistricting standards and probably lead to a lot more lawsuits around the country.
And Sean, just briefly as we wrap up, so this appeal sounds like is pretty much a sure thing. At the same time, both sides of this case, plaintiffs and defendant, have 30 days to come back with a response and a plan for that decision. So do these things happen at the same time?
I'm not sure how quickly it actually gets to the Supreme Court, because right now what we don't know is what is going to be the remedy in this case. This court, this three-judge panel, said that Wisconsin's map is unconstitutional. It didn't say what happens next. Is the court going to redraw these lines? Is it going to send it back to the legislature with these new principles, have them redraw the lines? There are a lot of big question marks that have to be taken care of before you even look at what happens in the appeal.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, joining us to talk about the federal ruling yesterday against Wisconsin's 2011 redistricting maps.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, new federal rules regulating overtime pay go into effect on December 1st. We'll learn about how the new rules will affect businesses and their employees in a little bit.
Right now, the idea of pilgrims and Native Americans sitting down for a Thanksgiving feast has been part and parcel of the holiday's lore.
But more important than a single meal was the knowledge about farming and the soil that the Wampanoag Indians shared with those settlers.
Susan Fisk is Director of Communications for the Soil Science Society of America, based in Wisconsin. She's the editor of their Soils Matter blog. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I've been introduced to something I hadn't even thought of. You're coming to a whole new continent. You're going to try to grow the same crops. The soil you're used to at home isn't necessarily what you're going to find there. And that's what the first European, the English settlers found. How big a difference was there?
Well, as it turns out, probably bigger than they thought. The English settlers who came were used to a soil that was very loamy. So soil has three different size particles, sand, silt, and clay. And a loamy soil has a really nice mixture and has a lot of what we soil scientists call organic matter. It is very easy to crush with the hands. The pilgrims, when they landed, ended up being on a sandy soil that didn't have very much organic matter. So it was much more difficult for them to farm.
And so how did they begin to bridge that gap, adjusting their farming techniques and picking up the knowledge about how to work with this new soil?
The other problem that the pilgrims faced was that they were not really trained as farmers. They were tradespeople. So they had to turn to their Wampanoag friends to learn how to do gardening or farming in the New England way. They also didn't have the tools that we might be familiar with today. So they took a lot that was part of an old Wampanoag village, and that's where they started their farming.
Was this a matter of they'd maybe brought over seeds and crops from England only to find that they're not maybe going to grow here?
Yes, I don't know about you, but I've lived in four different locations in the United States, and what you can grow very well in Massachusetts is different from what grows in Louisiana. And even living in Green Bay versus Madison, what you can grow in different zones is very different. So that is what they faced.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the Wampanoag tribe? Were they primarily a farming culture?
They were like other native peoples. They all had their own skills. Some were the fisher people. Some people did the farming. Other people took care of the clothing. So a lot, very diverse group.
So what kind of things on the farming side of things, what kind of secrets did they have to share with the pilgrims to help them make the best use of this new, different kind of soil?
They did have a few secrets. I think first they had to introduce them to the fact that the soil was just distinctly different, and they were going to have to grow different things. In England, they were not used to corn, and of course the corn isn't the same as the corn on the cob that we have today. It was a very dark purple corn. And they also taught them more how to hunt and to fish. So there were a lot of different tricks. And the last trick that eventually came, not the first year, But they taught the pilgrims how to grow different plant groups together so that they might cooperate. The example is called Three Sisters, where you grow corn, squash, and beans together. And beans are a really nifty plant because they can pull nitrogen from the air and turn it into nutrients for the plant. And it shares it with the corn and the squash. So it kind of has its own fertilizer.
So is that something that those first settlers would have seized upon, that Three Sisters, and used it to sustain them through those first years?
Yes, because having to leave, and usually farmers would have to leave a farm fallow for a few years so the nutrients could build back up in the soil. But these pilgrims couldn't afford to go for a whole year without growing anything. Fallow is when you just leave the field and don't grow a crop. So having the Three Sisters and being able to put nitrogen from the air into the soil allowed them to have better yields and also increase their nutrient content.
Talking to Susan Fisk with the Soil Science Society of America. That's based in Wisconsin. She's the editor of their Soils Matter blog, learning about how the pilgrims got some help adapting to new and very different soil when they came over from the old world, from the Wampanoag tribe in New England. I don't really think about the role of different kinds of soil in history, but as your blog says, soils matter. Is this is just one example. Is this something that that you look at in other eras of history too?
Yes, actually, last year, 2015, was the International Year of Soils, and we had 12 different messages for each month, and the role that soil has played in historical events is actually very important. December was Soils and Culture, and we think of the Great Dust Bowl. We think of soils in literature, the famous Sherlock Holmes mysteries. Sir Conan Doyle was using the clues that you might find in soil as one of the leads that Sherlock Holmes used. Soil is also used culturally for your war paint, or Egyptians even used it for paint. So there's a very rich history side of soil as well.
Now, you mentioned the Three Sisters, that this was the corn, the squash, and the beans that the Wampanoag introduced them to, this idea of companion planting. What other crops might have grown in those first years?
Anything that would be native to New England, and so that would be something like an ancestor of wheat, not the type of wheat that we would be used to. Wheat was wild at one point. They had things like wild strawberries growing on the beaches of Massachusetts. So learning to cultivate those native plants and adapt them to a new diet that they'd have to get used to.
You know, thinking about this, settling in a new world, and we're talking about maybe going to Mars someday. There are no Wampanoag tribes people on Mars waiting to help us farm there. What kind of things would you be thinking about in terms of trying to figure out what kind of soil is on Mars and what the heck we could do with it?
Oh, our soil scientists are actually studying that. And we got a lot of publicity last year when The Martian came out because we actually did a release on whether or not it would be practical to actually use, excuse me, your own poop to amend the soil in Mars. Yeah, to amend the soil in Mars to grow. And essentially, you could. We don't advocate for a diet full of potatoes, but actually beans would be something decent that a person could survive on for that length of time.
Now, I happen to remember from my Wisconsin history classes growing up that Antigo silt loam is the state soil of Wisconsin. How does our soil here compare to that New England soil that we're talking about?
Well, I grew up in Massachusetts, so I can tell you, and I don't know if you've ever been to Plymouth Rock, but it was a very beachy area. It was very sandy. We have a really nice loam here. And so it didn't hold as much water, it didn't hold as much nutrients as what we'd find in Wisconsin, which would be a lot more similar to what they would find in England.
Getting back to the Wampanoag, did they share, we've been talking about farming mostly, you mentioned that there are other people who were fishing, hunting, and trapping. Did they share those kind of secrets with the pilgrims who, I'm guessing, didn't know much more about fishing, hunting, and trapping than they did about farming?
Yes, the literature says that they did a large deer hunt right before the actual feast. And, you know, the woods were very different and very, very stark compared to what they might have found in England. Undeveloped Massachusetts, you know, was a very forested place.
What does that mean about the woods being stark? What is that difference?
They weren't as lush as you'd find in England. They were more barren at the time. Of course, there's more sugar maples in Massachusetts and more pines than you might find in a typical English countryside.
Now, talking about paying more attention to the soil of the past, do you think we pay enough attention to our soil and the condition of our soil that we rely on in the present?
We do not feel as though we pay enough attention to soil. And, you know, in humans' defense, we look down and there's soil. And we think it's we think it's everywhere, just like air and water. In the 70s, they passed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And soil at some point will probably get its own attention because it's a slowly renewable natural resource. It can take hundreds of years to make even a centimeter of new soil. So it's not like we just can keep using it up, just like water.
Do you think that the Wampanoag people have gotten the credit that they deserve for being a part of this first Thanksgiving story?
There's a lot of different museums out east that have different nations that are trying to explain their role in the history of the United States. And I think attendance at those museums would be a much better thing for everyone.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Susan Fisk is Director of Communications for the Soil Science Society of America, which is based in Wisconsin. She's the editor of their Soils Matter blog. She joined us to talk about how Native Americans shared their knowledge of farming and, yes, the soil of New England with the Pilgrims.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the new federal overtime rules going into effect on December 1st. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll hear about the uncertain future of the Affordable Care Act under a new president.
Now, on December 1st, new federal rules regulating overtime pay will go into effect. In just over a week, salaried employees earning less than $47,476 a year will be entitled to overtime pay.
But how will the new rules impact employees, and how will businesses, large and small alike, implement the new policies?
Carla Miller joins us now. She's a columnist with the Washington Post. She specializes in matters affecting the workplace. Carla, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start off with a look at these new in effect rules. We talked about them on the show when they came out. How big an increase is this salary threshold?
Well, the salary threshold is about doubled. So now, whereas before people making about $23,000 would be exempt from overtime, the Labor Department increased that threshold almost double, or more than doubled it, to $47,000. So anyone making less than that is now entitled to overtime for any hours they work over 40 in a week.
And the intent of this change in the rules, the reason we have this threshold is so that, as I understand it, an organization can't say, you're an hourly employee. No, now you're a salaried employee, so we don't have to pay you overtime, and you can work as much as we want you to now without overtime pay. Is that kind of the goal that is trying to be reined in here?
That's exactly right. The threshold had not been updated significantly since 1975. So you'd have workers, for example, in the food service industry or retail, making $25,000, and the employer says, well, you're a manager. You're doing manager duties, so we're going to pay you the same salary whether you work 40, 50, 60 hours a week. The goal of these regs is to update that income threshold so people can earn overtime if they're earning up to $47,000. And the goal was to make it more fair, to free up people so they're not having to spend so much unpaid time at work.
Now, we're going to talk about some of the specifics of what this is going to mean in the workplace. I want to throw an asterisk up here, though. There's going to be a new president, a Republican Congress that has had rumblings of maybe changing these rules, maybe back to the old way, just striking them down. Is there a chance that these will not be around for very long?
Well, that's a little outside my wheelhouse. I'm not much for political prognostication, but I prefer to speak to the rules as they are in existence now. The Congressional Budget Office actually released information estimating the revenue effects of what would happen if the rules were in fact canceled or rolled back, and that's available through the Labor Department's website if folks want to read more about that.
Right, and then we'll proceed through the rest of the conversation as though this is kicking in on December 1st and staying that way.
Let's just assume we're keeping the status quo. Yes.
Right, and now as I understand it, a lot of businesses, nonprofits, even government agencies, colleges are trying to figure out maybe still. Does this apply to me and my organization? And it sounds like if someone's asking that question, then probably, yeah, it probably does.
Yes, I actually received a question for the column, someone asking, well, does this apply to my business if we have fewer than 75 employees? And the answer is that it doesn't matter how many employees you have. What matters is whether your business does $500,000 a year in sales or other business income, or if individuals within the business are engaged in interstate commerce, which is a pretty broad net.
That means if I send an old-fashioned fax or work electronically, or there's a lot of things that fall into that interstate commerce category.
That's exactly right. Anyone who sends emails, uses the U.S. mail, these are things that cross state lines. Therefore, you're engaged in interstate commerce, and therefore, as an individual, you fall under these overtime rules.
Talking to Carla Miller from the Washington Post about these new overtime rules that are coming into effect at the beginning of next month, so just a week and a half or so before these kick into action. And Carla, let's say I am a business owner or HR department, you name it. I'm in one of these businesses. I've got employees in that transition zone. They're above the old limit, under that new limit, so I'm going to have to do something different now. What are my options? What can I do?
Well, there are a number of options that the DOL lists on their site. One option is that you keep your employees where they are at their current salary and just pay them whenever they go above 40 hours a week, go ahead and pay them time and a half based on their current salary, their current hourly earnings. Or you can bump the salary up so that they meet the new threshold, and then however many hours they work, they will not earn overtime pay for that. You can also, you could limit them to 40 hours a week, change them to hourly or keep them salaried, but say you can't work more than 40 hours in a week.
And there's been some pushback from employers and nonprofit organizations, too, saying one way or another, this is going to involve more accounting or I'm going to have to increase pay. It's going to cost us more money to do this. Have you heard a lot of questions and complaints along those lines?
Oh yes, and even among those, even among those who are protesting the rule, I should say most seem to agree that the rule is long overdue. It was time to update the income threshold. It's just that many folks disagree on the amount and how quickly it's happening. For businesses, this is creating something of an administrative burden. They have to take all their employees between the old threshold of $23,000 and the new threshold of $47,000 and figure out how they're going to handle those individuals. Are they going to bump up their salary? Are they going to limit their hours to 40? Are they going to start paying them overtime? And whatever option they choose, there's a chance that they could be losing productive hours or that they'll be paying out more money. They also argue, employers argue, that this is going to have an effect on employee morale. And employees who were previously salaried and had a great deal of flexibility with their work week, with however many hours they spent, they could knock off a little early on Friday. Employers argue that now these employees are going to have to keep track of their hours to make sure they're not going above 40. And for workers who enjoyed that flexibility, they might object to now having to keep track of every hour they spend on the clock. And they may also object to being bumped from salaried to hourly. Even if their annual income remains the same, there's an argument that the feeling of status is lost by having to change to hourly.
Did I see, and maybe it was in your column, this sounded a little complicated, but there might be some kind of flex time thing where if you're in a business that has a busy season before the big holiday rush or something like that, then you can sort of iron things out to where employees are working 60 hours those weeks and 20, 30 hours other weeks, and that makes up for it. Is that an option for businesses?
Right. That's called the fluctuating work week method. And it's, as you say, it's for businesses where employees might be working 50, 60 hours one week or, you know, 25 to 30 hours the next. And the way that works is the employer and employee work out an agreement where they have a base salary. And then the employee can earn that base salary every week, regardless of however many hours he or she works. But if the employee goes above 40 hours in a week, the overtime rate is half time rather than time and a half. I should caution that this is a very complicated method, and you shouldn't undertake it unless you talk to your HR department and a lawyer to make sure that your employees actually qualify for this method and that you're applying it correctly. Because it's possible, it is an option, but it's possible to get in trouble if you don't know exactly what you're doing.
And these rules were announced a while back. They come into effect December 1st. From where you're sitting, does everybody know this is coming, or are there a lot of people now just hearing about this and saying, oh, wait, what?
Well, even up to a month or two ago, I mean, these regs have been debated for a couple of years now. The order came from the administration in 2014. The Labor Department proposed the rules in 2015, and then there was a lengthy comment period. They received 270,000 comments. And then earlier this year in May, they finalized the rule. And you know, the Labor Department, HR departments, and associations, especially small business associations, have been scrambling to make sure that everybody hears about it. But there are still businesses who maybe they don't have an HR department, they can't, you know, afford HR or legal consults, and they're not aware that even though they may just be a few people, a few employees, that they're subject to this rule too.
We're talking to Carla Miller from The Washington Post. She's a columnist specializing in workplace issues. Talking to her right now about what you need to know about the new federal overtime rules going into effect on December 1st.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. What do you think of the new overtime rules? If you're a business owner, how have you dealt with these new rules? If you're an employee, what questions do you have about the coming changes? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking about the new federal overtime rules that will go into effect on December 1st and what you need to know as an employee or as a business owner. And we're taking your calls about the new rule. If you're a business owner, how are you handling the new rules? Or if you're a worker, what questions do you have about the process? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with Carla Miller, at work advice columnist for the Washington Post magazine. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Luke on the line in Madison. Luke, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Luke?
Hey, I've just been working in the food industry, specifically now right in the fast food business, and I think it's a great change. A lot of managers, especially general managers, assistant managers, they go into a job with a salary being told, you know, this is the amount of time you'll work, blah, 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 and they end up being taken advantage of just because they're salaried and there's no way to get around what needs to get done in a store or in a certain business, and they end up working a lot more hours than they thought they had.
Luke, thanks a lot for sharing that perspective. And Carla, I hear about this rule a lot in reference to fast food in particular, where you might get a promotion. Congratulations, you're a shift manager, assistant manager. You're now salaried over that old threshold. By the way, you have to work all the hours. So that's
right.
That's a place where it's going to change.
Sorry?
That's the place where it's going to change, this new rule.
Yes. It's going to change so that if you're working over 40 hours and you're not making that new $47,000 threshold, you are entitled to time and a half for those hours. And it may be that I understand a lot in the fast food industry, these managers are having to work a combination of, you know, sort of line worker jobs as well as management jobs as well as, you know, opening and closing. Maybe they'll have to be more sort of delegation of those other tasks so they can tend to the management side of things and get all that done within a 40-hour week.
So for an employee who's at a business, maybe in that or a similar situation, who doesn't think their workplace is observing these new rules starting in December, what do they do? What are their options?
Well, they can certainly take it to their managers or contact the corporate headquarters. Also, if they don't feel comfortable doing that or they're concerned about retaliation, I recommend they go to the Labor Department's website, dol.gov. There are lots of fact sheets and FAQs. There's a banner at the top of the page that talks about the new overtime rules, spells out what the rules are, so you can get an idea of whether you fall under them and if you're being treated fairly. If you suspect you're not, you should contact the Labor Department helpline, 1-866-4-US-WAGE. Or 866-487-9243. That's available on the website as well.
Luke, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Mary in Madison. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mary?
Yes, I'm not sure if you're aware of these sort of dealings, but I am currently a manager in food service, working 45 hours a week. And come December 1st, I'm going to be having a reduced hourly rate so that when I work 40 hours a week, I will not make my current salary, but then I will be forced to work an extra 7 hours at an overtime rate in order to equal out my current salary. Have you heard of anything like this? So basically I'm getting a cut in pay if I were to leave. Yeah, I'd be making a less per hour. Mm-hmm. But now I'm forced to work an extra 2 hours a week in order to make my salary so that the company can recoup a little bit of money.
Mary, thanks for the call. Carla, have you heard of that sort of thing?
I have heard of that sort of thing. And let me just take a moment and pause to point out I'm not a lawyer and this isn't legal advice, but my understanding is that is one of the options that that's available to employers. They can choose to reduce an employee's base salary. And they say, oh, you're making this much a year, but we need you to work 45, 50 hours a week. So we're going to reduce your base salary, and you're going to make that up with overtime. So you'll have to you'll be taking home less base salary unless you work those additional overtime hours to stay at the level that you were at before. That is an option. It's, you know, not ideal for workers, and you know, as Mary indicated, it's going to make workers pretty unhappy.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Carla Miller from the Washington Post Magazine, looking at new federal overtime rules that kick into effect at the beginning of next month. Brandon joins us next. He's on the line in La Crosse. Brandon, hi.
Hi, thanks.
What did you want to tell us about, Brandon?
Well, I guess I had a question about if your current salary is under the what's going to be the new threshold, but you get a certain percentage of commission. Wondering about, because my current commission is under what the salary threshold is as well, if I were to get everything. So would they be able to just raise my my potential commission to this new salary threshold? And would that bypass it, sort of as a loophole, I guess?
Interesting, Carla. That's a different wrinkle. Commission. How does that fit into this?
Yes, I'm a little fuzzy still on the exact details regarding commission, but the Labor Department has said that employers can use commission in part to make up this to make up income up to this threshold. I think it's something like 10%, but I would have to double check that with on the Labor Department website.
Brandon, thanks for that call, and good luck getting that sorted out. And I guess tipped employees usually would be hourly employees, not salaried, so that may not be a wrinkle that comes up as often?
I'm fuzzy on the details regarding tipped employees as well. As I understand it, they can use tips and commissions, but it's a small enough percentage that you couldn't rely entirely on tips to make up that difference.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Wade in Wisconsin Dells now. Wade, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
I've got a question concerning, I've got a few people on salary, and the majority of them will have to probably change to hourly or deal with some way that way. But my question is, I've got a general manager who passes the administrative test or the exemption, if you're calling it that. And I'm wondering if they have to pass the wage test and an administrative test, or if they just pass the administrative or the executive test, if that's enough to make them exempt.
Okay, so it's an executive position, a general manager, Carla, but it is under that $47,000 and change threshold. Would the law apply to them? The rules change, I should say, apply to them.
Yes. Well, if I can take a step back and just sort of give an overview of the rule that you're talking about, you have to meet, to earn overtime or to be exempt, excuse me, from overtime, you have to meet a salary threshold and also perform certain duties, administrative, executive, professional classification. Under the new rules, what they changed was the income threshold. They did not change the duties test. So the duties test remains unchanged. Anyone under the income threshold of $47,000, regardless of duties, is entitled to overtime. For the administrative exemption to kick in, the employee would have to be making $47,000 and fit into that administrative classification.
Wade, thanks for the call. So if Wade's general manager was a general manager making $50,000 a year, then that manager could be exempt.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck getting that sorted out, Wade. John is with us next in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We have a manager that works for us, and she makes under the threshold of the new law, but it kind of hurts her because we don't utilize her like over 40 hours a week like some other companies do, but she has the option of banking hours. So then if she does want a couple extra days off, she can take the days off, and she's still getting, she's still equaling out to 40 hours a week. But now with the new law, we have to put her into hourly, and she no longer has that option now of being able to have a little bit more flexible schedule, especially for us in the service industry where this month, next month is really busy, and we need her more than maybe we need her in February, where she can take a extra vacation if she wants.
John, thanks for the call. So that sounds kind of like an informal, maybe flex time sort of scenario, Carla. Is that sort of thing going to be harder under the new threshold with the new rules?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I should point out no one has to put employees no one has to change employees to hourly under the new rules. The Labor Department doesn't require that, but many employers may find that an easier way to sort of keep track of things. The most generous option would be to keep employees as salaried with their flexibility, but then pay them for any hours over 40 if they choose. But that's an extremely, extremely generous option. For this employee, that might be she might be a candidate for that fluctuating work week method we talked about earlier. If she consistently works significantly more or significantly less than 40 hours in a week, and they sort of those short and long weeks sort of balance out, she might be a candidate for that fluctuating work week method, where she gets paid a base salary and then gets paid half time for anything above 40 hours. But that really sort of illustrates the difficulty and the administrative burden that employers are facing in figuring out how to handle these situations and how to apply these rules. So I'd recommend talking to HR consultants, professionals, or talk to a legal department, maybe get a one-time consult to sort of work through what would be the best option that would be fair to the employee without creating too much of a cost or administrative burden on the employer.
Carla, as we wrap up, I mean, from the questions you're getting from people who write into your column, are you expecting maybe a little bit of a bumpy road as this starts to roll out, Nick, or as this kicks into effect next month?
It's possible. I haven't seen too much yet, but I think we'll see once people start getting their paychecks after December 1st. Maybe we'll start to hear more about that. I did hear from one person who wrote me some months ago asking about the rule and how it would be applied, and he came back to me and said that his employer had decided to bump his salary up to $25 above the new threshold. So he is salaried. He did get a raise, but he is also going to be working, you know, he's also going to be working without overtime as an option.
We'll leave it there for now, Carla. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Carla Miller, at work advice columnist for the Washington Post magazine. She's been talking to us today about the new federal overtime rules. They go into effect starting December 1st.
We're getting ready for Thanksgiving this week, and we want to know your favorite thing to have on the Thanksgiving table, traditional or untraditional. You can send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
I might check in with you on this again on Thanksgiving Day. You know, I like a lot of the traditional stuff I used to do, and I've mentioned this on the air before, Thanksgiving counter programming, like enchiladas or Thanksgiving lasagna and things like that. I've gone a little more traditional lately. How about you?
I'm very much a traditional kind of cook in the kitchen on Thanksgiving. As crazy as I get is going to be some mushrooms, which are Italian. They're from the Moosewood Cookbook, but everybody loves them. They're kind of autumnal, so we just go with that direction.
It's like a mushroom stuffing or just straight up?
Stuffed mushrooms, but they've got pine nuts, some red chilies, some breadcrumbs. Pretty yummy, simple.
You know, more and more, I'm the only one at the table who wants the drumstick on the turkey, so I went out. I get both of them, which is great. I like the dark meat.
Lots to look forward to when it comes to Thanksgiving tables, traditional or non-traditional. Don't forget, you can let us know what you like to eat on Thanksgiving over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.